My name is Catherine Gunn, and I was a whistleblower from GCHQ in 2003 about the Iraq War. So going back to the sort of topic of Pax Judaica, basically you've got to consider the evolution of Pax Britannica to Pax Americana. And now, in a period that more and more people are recognizing as Pax Judaica, which is a term that was brought up by an Islamic scholar called Sheikh Imran Hussein. And basically, he looks at it from a Quranic point of view about how the evolution of these various periods in history from Pax Britannica to Pax Judaica have evolved. And he s says that basically, these periods are controlled by evil, controlled by evil entities. And from my point of view, the reason it is evil is because the core principle is about enriching yourself at the expense of others. So the British Empire was enriching the, well, initially it started with privateers, the British East India Company, and they were enriching themselves at the expense of others. And the British Empire embraced that and carried on with that type of behavior and attitude. And so did the American Empire. Which, basically was ceded, the whole empire was ceded by the British Empire, and it eventually evolved to be the American Empire. When the British Empire allegedly collapsed, but the nexus of corrupt power ensured that they still had a foothold in the American Empire so that they could still retain influence and personal interest in the American Empire. So that's why we've got this Anglo-American Empire that developed from the Second World War and possibly even prior to that, right up to today. So this concept of basically tying all of your policies, everything you do, to this enriching yourself at the expense of others is actually, that's actually a contradiction, because you can't enrich yourself. You may think that you're enriching yourself, but eventually you will learn that you're not. You're actually hurting yourself. And as we see, what's happened to the UK and the US is that the empires are crumbling within, because instead of enriching themselves at the expense of others, they've been hurting themselves. Now we see, Britain collapsing because there's no inward investment, there's no maintenance of the original infrastructure that was built, and there's the same thing is happening in the US and the allies of the Anglo-American Empire, the Europeans. There's no inward investment into their societies since they started it. The alternative view.
Sorry, can I interrupt you? Because
Go ahead.
I think that if you look at the British Empire, for example, it was very successful. The problem seemed to be that the leadership around about 1900, maybe a bit before, and the individuals like Milner and Rhodes had got a bit greedy. And so although the whole thing was very well managed up until then, in terms of quite a lot of it in terms of public relations, if the term didn't exist back then, but in selling this idea that, oh, we're coming into trade, we're just being friendly, a bit like the old Phoenicians when they were going around the East Atlantic coast trading with people. But actually, their real interest is political and to take over. But then there's also the fact that the banking system became corrupted. So it's a bit like the fall of the Roman Empire. So it was doing very well. It's just that there was an outbreak of corruption at its heart. And if there hadn't been that outbreak of corruption, I'm not saying it wasn't corrupt in the first place, it probably was, but it just failed in management terms. It completely failed at the top.
Well, this is what I mean by it comes back to bite you by in trying to enrich yourself at the expense of others. It comes back to bite you. So you're ultimately not enriching yourself. So if
Yeah,
you
I guess so.
start off
What
on the
what you're doing is you're sort of promoting the wrong types of people by building an empire. The
But the
people who are
concept
just
itself is
greedy,
wrong. You can't have that thinking in the first place. So the seed of the concept is wrong. This is what I'm trying to get across, is that you can't try to subjugate the world to your will for your own interests, thinking that it is going to benefit you in the long time, in the long term. It doesn't. It's a temporary fix. It will come back to bite you in the end. And so this is why what the British Empire is waning, the American Empire is waning, because the original seed of the impetus was corrupt, was wrong, it was immoral. You cannot seek to enrich yourself at the expense of others. End of story. The alternative to that is enriching yourself whilst simultaneously assisting and helping others. This is something that I've, over the course of many years, have sort of assimilated. And it seems to me to be such simple truth. And yet I don't really hear it spoken about very much, apart from airy fairy terms about, karma, possibly, and loving your neighbor as you would love yourself. But in practice, the fact that you seek to help somebody, you seek to enable others to better themselves, that has a positive effect on you and thus enriches you. Now, the Quran speaks about this, no doubt, the Bible speaks about it as well. These two simple concepts, I think, have been buried under layers and layers and layers of mumbo jumbo. And I think what the corrupt nexus of power that we have in the continuation of the Pax Britannica, Pax America, and now Pax Judaica, what we have is what they fear the most is clarity and unity. And so, what they have been doing since they established this corrupt nexus of power is to constantly obfuscate and constantly distract the public, the masses, from having a clear vision of what's going on and to be united in purpose against it. And this is w why it's beginning to fall apart, because social media and the World Wide Web is a double-edged sword. And so, while on the one hand, we are beginning to gain more clarity through actual representations of the truth, and we are potentially able to gain more unity, they have the power because they control those technologies, those platforms, so they can censor and smear and continue to seek division, sow division, and continue to spread lies and misinformation and confusion. And so the reality is that the younger generation across the world is beginning once again, like they did in the 60s, to see the truth for what it is, that this corrupt nexus of power, which continues to seek the enrichment of itself at the expense of others, and they see it in the form of this continuing, ongoing genocide in Gaza. So, in order to con you know to c maintain power, they will have to continue to sow division and to create, alternative narratives and all sorts of other things in order to try and dampen down this clarity and this coalescing unity around the issue.
Well, yes, but this concept of the Pax Judaica, I think we need to understand a bit better what he's saying and where to see it. I mean, I would personally not use the word Judaica. There are quite a lot of Jews, and particularly Neturei Carter leaning rabbis, who actually say that what the Israelis are up to now, what the British Israel support groups, the Labour Friends of Israel, Conservative Friends of Israel, AIPAC, the lobby are up to is just trying to convince the world that they are in some way following Judaism. And many rabbis, vocal rabbis who don't get much exposure on the BBC, say this is nothing to do with Judaism, what they're up to in Tel Aviv. It's Zionism, not Judaism. But anyway, that aside, where do you see this Pax Judaica actually operating here in Britain? I've mentioned a bit about the lobby, but I mean, how on earth can they influence big organizations like the government, the BBC, universities, and all these, elite institutions? How can they do that?
Well, it's been going on for decades and decades and decades, and it's this mindset. It's also the concept of this, unbound capitalism, with corporations taking over the world and ruling, a sort of corporate takeover of the world. Again, the mindset of a corporation is to enrich itself at the expense of others. So, I mean, I keep coming back to that concept. Now, if you, so they're all self-interested in one way or the other. And the British Empire, the American Empire, that, I'm not talking about the people, but the corrupt nexus of power that is basically holding the nation to ransom, is using Israel, so they coalesce in a group around this whole concept of how to continually enrich themselves at the expense of us. And the ways that they do that is through total capture of everything, so in which they have been seeking to do over the course of decades as they've gradually taken over the n levers of power that people have, holding these corporations, these organizations, and various foundations to account for their behaviors. that sort of nexus, that those leverages of power have been whittled away from the average person into the hands of these entities, so that they now it's much harder to get your voice heard and get, retribution, compared to, going back 500 years when you could actually petition the king. It may have been very difficult, but you could petition your lord, you could petition the king. And, even going back 100 years ago, you knew where the heads of the bank, you knew where the owner of your local bank, you knew where he lived, you knew where the mining mine owner, you knew where he lived. He lived in the big house at the top of the village, and gradually we have become further and further removed from the nexus of power, because they've withdrawn into more and more elite sort of protected zones away from us, just like Downing Street has now, for the last however many years, had that enormous gate erected so that nobody can actually go down Downing Street. Because they realize that as people become more knowledgeable about what went on in the past and what is continuing on in the present and into the future, they need to protect themselves from us. And everything they've been doing is seeking to control the levers of power and seeking to enforce legislation so that they can use that, weaponize it against us, so that we can no longer, shout off with their heads,
Oh no, but we
storm their
can no, but
Bastille,
we can vote.
and
We
so
can
on.
vote them out, can't we?
Voting is a sham, Tony, because they also have controls of power when it comes to putting their men, their women in position. Unless, I mean, the c classic example now, which we can go on ad infinitum, is Jeremy Corbyn and how they ousted him from power with the lobby, as you say, because they realized that he had this incredible power at uniting people. And they don't want anybody who is able to unite people. So what they do is seed individuals into those positions whereby they divide instead of unite. So, like people like Nigel Farage, they're dividing people instead of uniting people. And they spread a message of confusion rather than clarity. They don't give you a real overall big picture look at what's going on.
Well, I mean, one thing with Corbyn, definitely, I think it's becoming clearer and clearer that the one idea that Corbyn had, which was it became unacceptable, was his support for the Palestinians.
Exactly. Because if you have unity of vision and unity of action on issues that have, they are historic crimes that need addressing, that need redress, they need solutions. Anybody who seeks to resolve those issues are going to be challenged, because the nexus of corrupt power knows that, they wouldn't be able to do the things they were doing if we lived in a society whereby the way to enrich yourself was by assisting and enabling others, right? And they've perverted our minds into thinking it's a dog eat dog world. It's a survival of the fittest. The only way to get to the top is by trampling over other people in order to get to the top. Eventually, what happens if you do that is your soul wastes away, your conscience wastes away, your ability to empathize and sympathize with others wastes away until you're a literal shell of your former self. And You have, you're no, you're lacking humanity. And so, this is why you see people like Tony Blair and Netanyahu and all these corrupt, deeply corrupt, immoral, evil people. They are being used now by evil, I believe itself, because they're literally ha they have n no kernel of conscience within themselves anymore. It has been whittled away until there's nothing left. And this is what happens if you pursue this path. And the only way to fight back against that is to try and build other people up at the same time as that will have a knock-on effect of making you a better person.
Well,
And
so
obviously you have to build other people up who are, not themselves seeking to enrich others at the expense of others, seeking to enrich themselves at the expense of others. So we have to come to a point where we have a clarity about who these people are, what they are doing, and they're using every channel, every issue to enrich themselves from not just military industrial complex, but the medical complex, the technological complex, the financial complex, the climate complex, every issue they've corralled into being used to enrich themselves at the expense of others. And unless and until we can see that, and unless until we can reject their narratives about what health means and what health is and what finance means and what finance is and what the economy means and what the economy is, and so on and so forth, we're going to be constantly battling against them and failing because their narratives will continue to lead others by the nose and away from the truth.
So when it comes to individuals, it seems we're getting increasingly isolated. The idea, it seems, is there was, I think, a conservative sex scandal and possibly a suicide scandal a few years ago, where it came out in the Daily Mail that there was in amongst the young conservatives this little expression, isolate, inebriate, penetrate, which was basically about the young conservatives getting hold of, I suppose, kind of innocent like supporters, female supporters, young ones, and just using it as some sort of the whole organisation as a sort of sex game, really. But anyway, this idea of isolation, I think, is quite important. I was this is 2011. We had quite a good little group here that met at once a week in Bristol, which was a part of the UK 9/11 Truth campaign, and we had a very active online bulletin board, which was doing almost all the news stories and comparing them to this kind of 9/11. The new American century that they were trying to institute through the September 11th attacks. And this guy came up to me. We were just handing leaflets out on the 10th anniversary in the city centre. A guy came up to me, and as I was waving a leaflet towards him, he says, "Oh, I don't want to know about 9/11." And I said, "Look, actually, we believe the whole thing was an inside job, blah, blah, blah." And he suddenly changed. His whole persona changed. And he could see he was tense, and he suddenly relaxed. His whole body relaxed. His persona relaxed. He's like, "Oh, right, okay." I didn't realize anyone in Bristol thought this too. So I've been thinking this for years, and so that isolation is broken in a situation like that, where people don't realize there are others around them that can also see through the lies. You know, the sort of silly, thin spread. I mean, we're asked to ex we're asked to accept complete and utter rubbish as truth every day, pretty much in the news. And look, there's also another way in which people are isolated, I think, is through just general poverty, pushed down into poverty. I know I interviewed David Southwell. There's a fantastic book he wrote, David, years ago, called The History of Organized Crime. And he also wrote another one, very good one, called Secrets and Lies, which is a sort of coffee table book about conspiracies. Anyway, David has disappeared off into the Freemasons these days and don't
Oh
hear
dear.
anything from him anymore. But he was a fantastic writer, and he had contacts in the security services, etc., in London. But what he did there is he explained how much they love poverty. Organized crime loves it because they've got all these poor people scrabbling around who will just jump straight onto organized crime. And the other byproduct of poverty, which we didn't see in Britain in the 60s and 70s. I remember the 1980s as seeing the first tramps, beggars on the streets of London. Well, they had tramps, but no beggars. Because there was facilities for them in the Thatcher era. The first beggars in London appearing after the Second World War is that there's no space in people's lives to get involved in things like pressure groups, campaigns, the old groups like Friends of the Earth that used to be so busy and successful, and Greenpeace also seem to have been co-opted into this sort of net zero agenda. And so there's very little kind of civil society and pressure groups to push back, which is the effect of poverty and isolation.
Exactly, and that's where they want us, because really they have no use for us, except to extract as much money as they can out of us, one way or another way. And basically the economies of the West have self-sabotaged themselves, as I said. They were, in this. Back when they were still able to produce things and make things, there was more unity, more community. But obviously, it was still a battle because, the lowest paid workers and the hardest working people probably weren't, they weren't the main focus of attention from the CEOs and what have you. But even the sort of difference in pay has increased exponentially since then. Back in the first half of the 20th century, maybe the difference between the top echelons of a corporation and the lowest was maybe 20 to 1, 30 to 1. And then it became 80 to 1, 100 to 1. And now it's sort of hundreds of thousands of times more than the lowest paid worker. So you, again, it's this extreme distance between those who've enriched themselves and people who are just trying to get by.
But surely, look,
And
it's more than that, because we are now in the situation where we've got millions of people on benefits, and the idea is now, I'm afraid, that work is no longer a route out of poverty, and you've also got millions of people on in-work benefits, so they're not extracting money from them, are they?
well, they are because they're extracting money from the people whiling away their time on their gadgets at home, So they want us to be dependent one way or other. And one could argue that that whole thing, working your way out of poverty, again, that was probably a con. If you really want to go back to the days when people had a skill and they had work that they were doing, whether it was as a carpenter or a basket weaver or until the big factories took over, when you had cottage industries and people, I'm not sort of trying to glamorize it, but when people had a skill, they were doing it in a way not necessarily thinking of it as if I produce X number of shoes, I'm going to make X amount of money. It was a whole different mindset, and our mindset has been completely altered in the last 300, 400 years to think in terms now where everything has a value, as a financial value. And this is a type of thinking which I think I've explained in previous talks that never existed before. It didn't exist 250, 300 years ago. The concept that everything has a financial value is a relatively new thing in human existence. And this perverts our view of the world. It perverts our understanding of the world. And so the people sitting at home doing nothing, not going to work, getting a minimal poultry sum from the government, they are having their wealth extracted simply by not being productive citizens, not being productive individuals. The person,
Well,
your
not being
own.
able to produce anything for themselves either, not being able to build up
Precisely.
their own, to build up their own. It seems like we're being isolated very much in that way too. I mean, you can look at the farmers just as one example, but right across the economy, the middle classes, people that used to own businesses on high streets, etc., you're seeing them all disappearing. You're seeing businesses collapsing.
Right. Well, it's all just being hollowed out because of this voracious, parasitical need of corporations to consume all. And they are consuming all. And they are privatizing everything. And they are financializing everything. And they are asset stripping everything because they've stopped producing. And this is what I was saying, that, we know that they transferred from a productive industrial society to a post-industrial society. They took that decision because they felt, again, this is the seed of enriching themselves at the expense of others. So they didn't consider the fact that all these workers would lose their jobs. They would enrich themselves, nevertheless, by exporting all of the work to other countries who paid lower wages and had no maybe health and security and insurance and what have you, at the expense of their own people. And now, because they've lost that ability to produce and they've lost the skills of people who are able to build and engineer and produce, they don't know what to do now because China's taken that, picked up that baton, and China is doing it. And so, consequently, the only way they can extract wealth is to tokenize everything and financialize everything. And this is what they're seeking to do. And I see it as basically the West. So you have real assets, real production, real products on the one hand, produced by China and perhaps other allies of China and Russia. And then in the West, you have what they're trying to engineer now, I think, is the tokenization of all of those assets and products and raw materials and so on, so that they still have control of the system by saying, if you want to buy that, you've got to pay this carbon credit, or if you want to use that, you've got to pay the subscription fee. And this is the model that they're working towards, so that we will no longer in the West own physical assets. We will no longer have any of the actual commodities. We will simply own digital copies or be able to access them through monthly subscriptions.
Well, let me just say something about things that are going on here in Bristol, which illustrate that a bit. Well, one is the they're talking about charging people to go into parks, for example. They're also there's been a series of evictions of traveller sites here over the last, well, since COVID, really. Discrete sites, maybe with about 50 caravans or trucks on them. They've all been evicted, so that people are basically curbside. And then the council's saying, well, actually, what we're doing is we're now taking over those sites with the landowner, putting massive iron steel fencing all around them, and you're going to pay 30 quid a week and council tax to move into them. So all the things that we used to expect, including things like this idea of people being able to just live by the side of the road if they've got a vehicle or a caravan, that all seems to be going.
Right. And they're normalizing it. This is something the younger generation is not going to know any different, right? Many of them know no different. They think everything comes with a subscription. They think that, digital copies of things means you own it. No, you don't. And I think if we somehow can reach them that this is not the norm, this is not the way it needs to be, this is not how it should be, this is an issue that really needs addressing because it can be turned off or restricted once they have total control of our payment systems and so on. When if they can eradicate cash, which is also what they're trying to do, if they can get rid of people's use of cash, then all of these things will be completely within their control. And you can just see how literally there is no obstacle to who they will target. They are targeting anybody who is against them. People like the UN Special Rapporteur on refugees and the young people being aware of what's normal and not normal about, and
Yeah,
cash and
well,
those sort of things.
every generation grows up with new norms, doesn't it? In fact, I was chatting with a young person recently who was just like seemed completely bemused about this idea of 1960s and 1970s, where all the infrastructure was owned by boards and by the government, which Thatcher sold off, as well as at the same time. Releasing all these exchange controls, so it enabled ma massive foreign investors to come in and just buy up Britain's infrastructure. But anyway, I wanted to say something about what happened after the war, which is if you listen to people like Alex Craner or Steve Hall or Michael Hudson, what they'll say is that in the banking system in the City of London, there were big changes because even though there was still a fantastic amount of industry that Britain had just fought World War II with around the country, the Bank of England was totally refusing to invest in anything. And this was a conscious decision because it was led by the US. And this was absolutely crucial in sort of shutting industry down in Britain. And that's been also crucial in changing our cities from places where people came because there was industry to work together to places which are sort of, cities like Sheffield, Birmingham, even, and certainly here in Bristol, where people are kind of looking around saying, well, why are we in this city? What's the point? What's the purpose of it all? So that was a deliberate thing. That there was a la the deliberate lack of investment in British industry, basically just to run it down.
Well, that was the transition from Pax Britannica to Pax Americana, was that period. And Britain was bankrupt, basically, from the war. The US profited extremely well from the war. And there's a whole different, there's a whole other story about how, in fact, US corporations enabled the Nazis. They were very much in league with Nazi Germany. And what, and they actually thought, the US corporations actually thought that Nazi Germany might win. And they were hedging on that. But when they realized that it wasn't going to win, they had to quickly, very quickly cover their steps and cover their involvement
Yeah, it's
with
worth
Nazi
mentioning the
Germany.
book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler by Anthony Sutton, who really does document all that very, very well.
So the US basically became supremely wealthy from that point onwards. And the British Empire was crumbling, you know, because essentially these things can't work. As I said, they don't benefit you in the long term. They may benefit you temporarily, but because it is not in anybody else's interest other than your own, it will eventually disintegrate. And this is why the British Empire collapsed and disintegrated, and they restructured it into a Commonwealth, desperately trying to cling on to the overwhelming advantage they had grabbed for such a tiny, tiny island on the periphery of the European and Asian landmass. They managed to retain substantial amounts of control and influence by converting it into a Commonwealth, their empire, and by tagging themselves onto the brawn of the US military might. And thus it continued. But at considerable expense to the common people of the British nation itself. As you say, because the British establishment, the corrupt nexus of power, and those who influence anybody who has alternative ideas and tries to do things differently, they immediately get rid of them and put one of their own people in so that they can continue with this agenda, was not to improve. I mean, they did try to maintain the systems of like the NHS and so on. The concept was good initially, but again, it got corrupted because they were trying to, you know, enri trying to enrich themselves one way or another way. You cannot use these systems to enrich yourself. They are meant to be a public service. They are not meant to be a profitable thing, and neither is education, and neither should housing be a means to enrich yourself. It is a public good. You need to have shelter in order to function properly. You need to have water in order to survive. You need to have energy in order to keep your house and everything functioning. And so on and so forth. All of these things are a public good, not a private interest. And they've been converted into a private interest. And we've been propagandized to accept them as private interest, not public good. And thus we are in the situation we are, so that the vast majority and the middle classes are being hollowed out. Nobody's denying that. The middle classes everywhere in Europe, America, UK being hollowed out. And instead of uniting, instead of seeing that it's this predatory thing at the top, which is cannibalizing the rest of us, instead of seeing it for what it is, instead of having a clarity of vision, a unity of mind, we are being torn apart. We're being allowed to be torn apart, blaming this, that, and the other group below us instead of that nasty thing above us.
Well, look, there's an unconscious and a subconscious side to this as well, which is to do with and with our morale. The idea is to put up, very, useless celebrities. I think it was in the 1970s. I remember "No More Heroes" song by the Stranglers when I was at school. And actually, it seems to me that that's the idea, that there is nobody really around anymore that you can say is a good example to young people. And those that are put up as a good example, certainly in the world of politics, are very often immediately then just destroyed or proved to be completely hollow. So this is a subconscious and an unconscious effect on the whole of the, at least the Europe, United States, and Britain. It is to just demoralize everybody.
Right, and this narrative, which again has been pushed primarily in the West, that there is a knight in shining armor, there is a hero to the rescue, has been prevalent within our mythology for eons. And again, it's problematic because, it's handing over your power and control to an illusory thing, and you're not owning your own responsibility in the situation. You're
But
not
are you
owning
handing
your
it
own
over?
power.
I mean, it's being
Or
taken from you, isn't it?
you are handing it over in the sense that you're basically becoming a you're opting out. You don't need to do anything because somebody else will do it. Right? And
But even if you wanted to do it, can you? Surely not.
Well, it depends because if everybody thought we can do something and they come together and they do something, I mean, look at the poll tax movement. Look at the truckers back in the 90s
Well,
when
okay, but I
petrol
know.
prices went up by, I don't know, 1 or 2 pence. And they came out en masse and blockaded the bloody depots and said, we're
Yeah, well,
not
that's right. I mean, they
tolerating
see the
this.
similar sort of thing from the farmers. But look, Corbyn is the obvious example. Seems to me what happened there was Corbyn was allowed to run. He was a Labour leader for quite a while. He was allowed to just sort of garner support. Once it had become everyone's eggs were in Corbyn's basket, the head was chopped off.
Well, I think they just re they I think Corbyn, I mean, he's not perfect. By no means is anybody perfect. The point is, he certainly had a message that resonated with a lot of people, many, many hundreds of thousands of people, which is why 500,000 people joined the Labour Party when he became leader, and it was a complete fluke when he became leader. And it was this when the corrupt nexus of power realized, look, he's coalescing all these people around him. He's bringing clarity of understanding to people. He's bringing a unity to people. That's when they decided they had to destroy him, because of his ability to gather people around him. It doesn't mean that he would act alone and take charge and sort of become this dictatorial figure. No, I mean, he's anything but that, right? Everybody blames him for being too conciliatory and too much of a peacemaker. He's not, he didn't stand up against them when they started to attack him. He became apologetic, and this is not. We must learn, people must learn lessons from his sort of inability to see the dangers of the evil forces.
Well, I mean, surely, Catherine, that Corbyn was allowed to get where he was because the powers that be knew that they could
I
topple
don't
him.
think it, no, I no, I don't think it's necessarily as, I think it was a flux. It was a complete flux how he became leader. fluke rather, not it was a complete fluke
But
how
if
he
you
became leader.
compare it, say, to what happened in Egypt, I mean, it's a similar thing. There was a big opposition with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, a very successful, a horrible military dictatorship there. And we're seeing a sort of similar thing developing in Pakistan, another place in the Muslim world, where the Morsi and the Brotherhood were allowed for a short period of time to take over and start to run things. And that was used as a sort of they were the powers that be were biding their time, the forces of darkness, if you want, to identify all these people. Who was it that was going to try and run the country under the Brotherhood? And then, of course, there was another coup. All of those individuals were arrested. Many of them were then executed. So it seems to me that the evil forces will allow a Corbyn or a Morsi to pop up for a brief time, but only for enough time to identify exactly who they are, put them all under surveillance, and then take them out.
Well, that's a rather black way, I mean, of looking at things. In a way, if you subscribe to that sort of view, then ultimately, why do anything? Why bother?
No, I know. Listen, I do understand, and lessons are there to be learned from all of this. But I mean, it seems to me the West is being basically told by the financial system, and also, of course, by the mass surveillance that's now going on. We haven't even really touched on. And there was a deliberate move with Thatcher and from Wall Street for and people like Kissinger, obviously, in the Nixon era. For China to then start to take this role over as and it is now China is a massive force, and we're seeing the good old dollar, the petrodollar from the Second World War, starting to crumble. And of course, in terms of money and finance, these reserve currencies are critically important. They get very little scrutiny from your Faisal Islams or your Robert Pestons, these various finance correspondents in the London media. They don't really look at all of this, but there's some enormous changes been going on with these reserve currencies.
Yes, and I think this time it's different because of the enormous power that social media has, and which these technocratic, well, these tech oligarchs in the West who have complete control over the platforms and so on. And they are definitely part of this corrupt nexus of evil power. I mean, these individuals are deeply corrupt, deeply evil people, I believe. And so nothing good will come of what they do. But they have, unlike previous scenarios, where there was a relative, like the Roman Empire, they had a, I guess their currency was a global, you could describe it as a global currency. And the Spanish had silver. It was very widely used, the Spanish silver. That was a global currency. And to an extent, the British pound was a global currency. And they all eventually collapsed under the weight of their own problems. But the American dollar, although it is very devalued, and it's there are huge unresolved problems in the US because of this inevitability of the evil that it visited upon the world, and is thus it's you could describe it as karma. But and the people will say, but I didn't do I wasn't involved in it. I had nothing to do with it. That may be so. You know, there are good people. There were people who were fighting against this evil. Unfortunately, everybody will suffer, and this is what, you know, this is the way of the world, but the good people will suffer along with the bad. But if your conscience is clean, if you try to fight against this evil in your lifetime, then your soul is going to be at peace in the next world. And I do believe in the next world, and I do believe that we have souls, that our consciences are our souls, and we are born with it, and we know from birth, from infancy, what good and evil is, what, and we know that by only trying to do things for ourselves, we hurt. We are at risk of hurting others if what we do for ourselves brings risk to others and harm to others. So this is inevitable, what is going to occur in the West, the collapse of the dollar, and it's going to impact a lot of nations. I believe BRICS nations, led by China and to some extent Russia, they don't want to see harm come to everybody, you know, the Joe, everyday Joes, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Smith and who and whoever. They don't want people to suffer necessarily, unnecessarily so. And so they are trying to build an alternative system. But of course, the corrupt nexus of power in the heart of Washington, London, Tel Aviv, they're not going to willingly hand over this power. They don't want to hand over the power. And I believe they had tried to get Beijing, get Moscow on side over the years. Kissinger's, you know, various approachments, rapprochements to China was an attempt to do that. But China has insisted on maintaining control of their own systems. And whether you agree with how they do things or not, whether it's overall good or overall bad, you know, that is subjective, I think. The fact is, China has lifted huge numbers of people out of poverty, not just in China, but around the whole region. They've lifted many millions of people out of poverty. And they state that as their policy. You know, they don't beat around the bush.
Well, that's like the Labour Party. They have just ended the two-child benefit cap, lifting kids out of poverty.
Right. So you can see there's a real difference, you know, where the Labour Party endorses austerity and, you know, all this nonsense about public-private partnerships. The Chinese government is focused on eradicating extreme poverty that still lingers in pockets in rural areas and so on. And if they get this alternative financial system up and running with totally different transactional rails, that don't use our systems at all. They're a total separate system. Eventually, other governments around the world will see the benefits in that, and they will start linking their systems to the Chinese system and building bridges. And eventually, the corrupt nexus of power here will realize, that they will simply only control their own little spheres of control.
Well, that's if Trump doesn't get away with his tariffs.
Wow, so this is the problem, and this is it's a very I can't predict the future. Nobody can really predict the future. Sheikh Imran Hussein believes that, a great war is coming, although he doesn't. He hopes it doesn't. But the fact is, if they're crazy enough, they will try to trigger a war in order to derail all of this. However, that might have the knock-on effect of accelerating the process. We don't know because cause and effect are curious things, and we don't really know how it's going to play out, just as the, crazy amount of sanctions on Russia didn't actually prevent Russia from strengthening itself. It had the opposite effect, actually enabled them to do more things themselves and better themselves, and it improved their own ability to do things. And just as it's done in China, how sanctioning tech has simply allowed them to increase their own production of these things. So, and likewise, the tariffs. The tariffs simply add cost to the end user. So it doesn't have the effect that they pretend to say it has. Unfortunately, unless people in the West realize what's happened and why it's happened, why we're in the state we're in, it won't change.
Do you think people are right to compare China? Well, they've got a mixed economy. In other words, they've got quite a massive part of their infrastructure is in state hands, including most finance. And that's how Britain was basically back in the 19 late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. You could actually compare the two countries. Obviously, the Chinese Communist Party versus democracy is very different, or maybe, but the actual way the economy was organized as a mixed economy, which is blending some private entrepreneurism with public ownership of infrastructure and key industries, I mean, it's a similar thing, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there were some, there were some individuals, some organizations in the UK which tried to keep on top of these things. But inevitably, the most ruthless people with the most wealth, the most levers of power will eventually overrule you. They will, they will take over from you. And this is what happened in the UK. And the question is, can you have a parliamentary system, which at the minute is barely functioning as it should do? Can you have a parliamentary system whereby, or any type of so-called democratic system, where you can actually effectively control the most dangerous elements in society, which are finance and corporations. These two entities exist to enrich themselves at the expense of others. That's the problem. They're not going to reform themselves. They can't, because the way they are designed is not designed to benefit others necessarily, unless they're completely, somehow the whole system is overturned. And they're trying to, you see, I think they're trying to present a narrative that they're doing this, and this is what the climate, carbon credits, and all the SDGs, what that is, because they realized with the Occupy movements and the yellow vests and all these types of movements, they realized at the end of the 90s and the 2000s that people have cottoned on to the fact that corporations and banks are not there to help you. They're not there for you, they're there for themselves. And so all of these SDGs and the climate change carbon credit nonsense is a whitewash. It is, or a greenwash. It is an attempt to present a facade that these entities can be controlled and can be, basically functioning for the good of everybody.
Well, the idea, it seems to me, is to present the planet as like more important than people, and so this is why you're going to have to knuckle down. You talking about the corporations reminds me of the, I think it was a Canadian made film in 2003 called The Corporation,
Yes.
which is, many people have not seen. I don't know if that's ever been on British television, but it's like many films, actually many good documentaries, including one which names escapes me at the moment, which is about the new kinds of currencies, and the new sort of green financial agendas. So there's a lot of but the corporation is, the idea is, it's as the film explains, and it goes into lots of detail about how and why, is actually considered to be a person, and it's treated in law as a person.
Without any of the responsibilities.
Exactly, and nobody's interested in corporate manslaughter, corporate murder, or corporate criminal damage charges, because although it likes to have the legal guarantees of being a person, and in fact a immortal person. So, for example, a corporation will not be paying inheritance tax on anything.
No, right.
Okay, so what about the Chinese, though? Because, as I said, and I'd like you to address this if you can, is the mixed economy there, although it's an authoritarian system with President Xi in the driving seat, apparently, although it does look really as if he's more of a kind of puppet. This balance between private and public seems to be working very well in China, and actually, maybe the potential war to come that Imran Hossein is talking about is really a conflict between two different ways of running your country or running your empire, which is, one of them is where you have a government that, whether you vote for it or not, is going to ensure the infrastructure. Another one where finance capitalism, anarcho-capitalism rules.
I recently watched a documentary by a journalist called Ben Norton, and his channel, Geopolitics and Empire, I think, I can't remember, but I'll send you the link if you want to have it yourself. And it's basically called, his video is called "What is Socialism with Chinese Characteristics?" This is how China's economic model works. And it's a very good documentary. I mean, whatever you think about China and a lot of the sort of propaganda about China, I mean, there are problems with China. And I think, you know, hopefully people in China will eventually understand this. But anyway, this documentary, he talks about how there's a concept which was introduced by, I can't remember who he said it was, whether it was Deng Xiaoping or any other Chinese leader at the time when they opened up to market forces. But he said they described it as a birdcage system of economics. Or so the bird in the cage is a corporation. And they said that corporate the bird cage itself could expand to allow the bird more freedom of movement and so on. But nevertheless, the bird, i.e. the corporation, is kept within that bird cage. And he also went on to describe how, in, you know, when the Chinese housing bubble developed, and that's because basically they had attempted to create wealth in the system. So they devolved the sort of, they allowed local counties and mayors and different, you know, local regional government to sell off land in order to develop their own local economies. And actually, China's very devolved system. He also goes in to explain this, how all the various counties and locations, the power is very devolved. So this idea that President Xi is controlling everything is not true. They have a very collaborative sort of a very bureaucratic system that goes up and up hierarchically, but people have the power to petition upwards and upwards and upwards. But their main local authority is as who's responsible for a lot of the governing of things. And so when the local a government started selling off land and so on, that inevitably created a housing bubble. And so banks and building societies and so on were lending money for the purpose of buying land and building property and so on. And big companies like Evergreen and what have you. And the Chinese government realized that this was an untenable situation and that they had to do something about it. And so they deliberately popped the housing bubble. And he doesn't go into how exactly they did that, but they deliberately popped the housing bubble such that housing prices did come down. And obviously, some people would feel that that was not a good thing because they may have been trying to invest in property in order to benefit themselves. But obviously, as I said, housing is a public good, or it should be considered. Shelter should be considered a public good. So those people who benefited are probably in vast quantities more than the people who suffered. So because prices came down, more and more people were able, the sort of people who had previously thought that prices were going beyond their reach, suddenly were able to then get back on the property ladder. And the result of implementing some restrictions on banks in lending, I think, to asset purchases, banks were then they were focused then on lending into the productive economy. And so suddenly industry and business took off because lending went into the productive economy. And this is something that a professor, Richard Werner, has talked about, and he also uses China as an example and how Deng Xiaoping had basically realized that you can't create wealth in a country by having a very totalitarian system and one single bank like they did in the Soviet Union. You had to have a multitude of banks across the nation, from small to medium to large banks, in order to benefit the small mom and pop shops, the small businesses, the medium businesses, and the large businesses, and so on and so forth. And they realized that actually it is commercial banks that create the economic engine. They bring money into the immediate surrounding local economy. And what we see in the West is that this system has been turned around and it's being centralized increasingly into bigger and bigger, fewer and fewer hands. And this is a process that has been ongoing for many, many years. The UK was already extremely highly centralized compared to other countries. And Germany, as Professor Richard Werner described, was very economically strong because it had hundreds and hundreds of local banks, thousands of banks in Germany. And of course, the ECB has been, as he described, destroying German banks. And it's also, well, Britain was already a highly centralized system.
Yeah, because I can remember in the 1990s, you would every single town, not just cities, all towns, all market towns had various branches of their various banks, each of which had a bank manager who you could go up and have a chat to, shake his hand or
Right, they
whatever.
knew your customer. Now this whole know your customer thing isn't a face-to-face thing of knowing your customer.
No, it's
It's
AI.
become this digital AI thing, right? Your address, your facial recognition, your national insurance number, your this, that, and the other. And that doesn't mean they know you at all. They don't know how credible you are, they don't know how reliable you are, they don't know, So,
They don't want
exactly.
to
So
know.
they don't want to know. Exactly. And so China has, they have a completely different mindset. And it's hard for people to get their minds around it. I don't know whether eventually it will become corrupted, like we have become, the market forces. But China, it seems, is at the moment determined to keep control over corporations, preventing them from becoming cartels and monopolies. So he talks about, and also, unionization is protected in China. So according to Ben Norton, Walmart has businesses in China. But Walmart in the US is anti-union, and there are no unions within Walmart in the US. Whereas in China, the government insisted that Walmart must allow its premises in China to have unions. And eventually they've succeeded. So Walmart in China now has a union, has a specific union.
I mean, it does seem like you're sort of agreeing that this is a war between two different systems.
I
And
think it
that,
is.
yeah, going back to Evergrande, by the way,
Evergreen.
the collapse of this massive property company. This was precipitated around about started to they started to go down around about 2018, 2019, and really hit the buffers when it came to COVID. There was also, of course, in the background to all of this, rising tension around the world, with the collapse of the European and American economies during COVID, and the enormous collapse in global trade. So it could be that that the Chinese were projecting their housing for a big increase in GDP, massive increases in production, which never happened. And so they're building all these houses for towns and industries, etc., which didn't actually happen. So that is another way of looking at what happened with the property collapse in China. So they're basically being optimistic. They're building for a very, expanding their industries, etc., and then finding, right, well, COVID has happened and various other things have happened, and those optimistic projections aren't really going to happen anymore. But I'd like to sort of come to a bit of a conclusion here in looking at China and the US more generally, because there is a complete and same in the UK actually, a complete like impossible. It's impossible for. I mean, we've had this collapse of the spy trial in London. It's like it's complete schizophrenia. So China is the enemy, but we've got to be friends with them because it's so important to carry on trading with them.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is, as you say, it's schizophrenic. So until and unless there is a World War III, they are hedging their bets, So they have to continue. I mean, they cannot completely bifurcate the two systems. They cannot not trade with China because China now has become the biggest producer of basically all essential components of any type of industrial production, with all the various processing of minerals and production of chemicals and so on. They're basically in total control of the whole foundation in the production of anything. In order to produce anything in a factory, in any type of laboratory or factory, you need precursors and all sorts of essential components, very basic foundations of anything. And China basically has, they've got the entire control of that supply chain because they, when they decide, realized that NATO, this nexus of corrupt power is attempting to overthrow their system and cannibalize them, they realized they had to produce everything themselves in order to be self-sufficient. And so that's what they did. And they built up their capacity to refine and produce all the things that are necessary in order to produce other things. And so the West is basically now, we're dependent on them for those very things. And our capacity to produce them have been so depleted. And our knowledge base has been depleted because we exported it all when we decided to deindustrialize. All of this is coming back to bite us in the ass. And instead of because they're incapable of thinking beyond themselves, we are not going to get out of this mess. Unless we're able to resist. And so people like those, there was a massive protest in London recently against digital ID. We have got to come together and acknowledge the beast and address the problem. But we mustn't fall into the trap of thinking, oh, anything that's described as a public good is authoritarian. I reject fundamentally a type of socialism or what have you, which is authoritarian. I reject authoritarianism because, again, that is seeking power and control for itself. It must be diffuse and it must be sort of a big umbrella. And people within the left who tend towards the green side and the whatever side, but who are generally this mass on the left, have got to realize that health does not come through pharmaceutical products and needles and MMR technology and all this crap that is poison. It's not for your benefit. It's never been for your benefit. It's always been for their profit margins. There is no good, nothing at all beneficial in a needle, in a vaccine. There is nothing beneficial in pharmaceutical drugs. All they do is mask symptoms, but they poison you. There is nothing good in chemotherapy. It poisons you. People on the left and in the green side of things have to come to realize this for us to get past it all. The trouble is, China also is beginning to think like this because they send their students over here to learn this bullcrap. They're poisoning their own historical understanding and thinking and beliefs with these poisonous sciences.
It does seem to me there's quite a lot of links at the top level between elites in the West and China. But anyway, look, let's round off by just looking at the briefly at some. I mean, I've got a couple of books which I'm recommending this Christmas. One is it's a bit late to order things now, but anyway, the point is they're good. You know, there's some good stuff out there. I've been recommending Cynthia Cheung's book, which is The Empire on Which the Black Sun Never Set. She's based in Montreal. There's also this Pornocracy, The Machinery of Mass Degradation by Joe Bartosz, which has just been published. But the ones I'm really thinking about are more Norman Baker and Paul Holden, because Norman Baker is the former prisons minister, etc., in the coalition government. His book is Royal Mint National Debt. Subtitled The Shocking Truth About the Royal Finances, because whilst we, you know, the royals are really, really aggrandizing wealth to themselves, in fact, giving themselves massive pay rises at the moment,
They're
and of course,
deep in
less
the
and
thing.
less accountability. But then there's also this book put by Paul Holden, Fraud, which is all about the Zionist lobby funneling masses and masses of money through shell companies to get Keir Starmer elected leader of the Labour Party. So is there any, either one of those two you'd like to talk about, the rise of Starmer through corrupt financial, and of course this is should be prosecuted, all this stuff. It's just not being.
Of
The
course,
police have
of
not
course.
prosecuted it. And
Right.
also, of course, the that we are with people like Rob Evans at The Guardian, they're finding they can the freedom of information requests, etc., anything to do with the royal family, it's basically a bit like your birdcage. We're not allowed in. We're not allowed to know anything really about the way the royal family operates. So pick one of those two and say, or maybe even both, and say what you think about Starmer and Tampon Charlie.
Well, again, they're all, they're part of this beast. I mean, there's very little, there is no one really in the public sphere that's on BBC or on Channel 4 or on in the, any of the press, who is anybody we can take seriously as somebody who is an authentic, genuine being. So this comes back to the issue of where does power lie? Power lies ultimately with us, but we've been brainwashed into believing that we don't have any power. And what does it mean? I mean, it's easy. I'm not saying I'm a brilliant example. What does it mean to be in your power? It means you are willing to suffer and you're willing to not.
Risk.
You're willing to take risks, exactly, and you're willing to be to not go the convenient route, you know. And we're being forced into this position. And if you're and they will obviously try to make things difficult for people who don't want to collaborate. They will make life hard for you. And if you take the bait and you say, well, it's too expensive, it's too hard, it's too inconvenient, I'll just go along with it. You are sabotaging your power and you're sabotaging the future for your children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews and whoever. Because you're handing, again, more and more power over to them. And this fight back against digital ID and so on, this is very much fundamental to it. Because, as I said earlier about the tokenization of everything, when they've got total control over your payment system and your digital ID, then we've lost. You know, there will be very little else you'll be able to do. Forget living out in the back of nowhere in a camper van, and they'll come and get you. There will be nowhere to hide, nowhere to run. So you have to get on board, whether you think the people screaming and shouting about digital ID on the right are the loony, you know, fringes of the right. If you even if you believe that jabs are good for you and that you've got to get your flu jab every year to stay healthy and the COVID was real and you had to have the COVID jab, even if you believe all that, at the end of the day, they're coming for you. Because those people who believed in the jabs, believed that COVID was real, believed that you had to mask up and keep your 6 feet distance and all the rest of that, they're the ones now who are screaming about Palestine and saying, how can you let the Gazans die like this? So wake up, folks, wake up. They've never, ever been about you or your health. Never. Please wake up and realize that the people on the right who don't necessarily see things as you do about Gaza, they need to wake up for God's sake about Gaza as well. We've got to come together because they are cannibalizing all of our futures. Our children and our grandchildren and our nieces and nephews and their children and grandchildren will not be able to fully evolve as human beings if we hand over control to this beast.
Well, I
So
suppose
at this
at least we'll be able to join an anti-slavery campaign, maybe.
Right, but at this Christmas time, you know, we need to think about what it means about being truly human and being a, if you're a Christian, a follower of Jesus, what would Jesus do? And if you're a follower of Prophet Muhammad, what would Prophet Muhammad do? I think fundamentally what Sheikh Imran Hussein is trying to bring people's awareness to is that whether you're a believing Jew and you believe that Zionism is a evil and you believe that Israel should never have existed, or if you're a believing Muslim and you believe that, God wants us to accept everyone and that there should be tolerance and moderation and kindness among peoples. Or if you're a Christian and you believe that Jesus wants you to be an example and lead a upstanding life, we need to all come together because at the end of the day, we all end up passing into the other world. It's the same place we're going to, I believe. There are no, not, there's not a Christian heaven and a Muslim heaven and a, we're all passing on our souls into a different place, and eventually we'll understand it all. None of these divisions between us all matters in this world. We need to come to realize that because ultimately we'll all be together again in the other world, in the next world. Our souls, minus our egos, will be on the other side. That's my belief.
Okay, Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Have a very happy Christmas.